From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Open lines next hour, and for the rest of the program, I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say. Monday is a holiday, President's Day, but keeping with our promise, if a holiday falls on a workday for me and our staff, we will not be gone. That is assuming I'm not on vacation somewhere. Not to worry. We will do the show live, and as a matter of fact, I was looking at the holiday calendar for the rest of the year. Every holiday this year, every one, falls on a regular workday, so we'll be here. And my staff loves it. They get double time. The last hour of the show tonight, a chat with the attorney and indirectly with the mother of alleged time traveler John Teeter. Get ready for this one. I've had an opportunity to listen to it now several times after conducting the interview, and it just gets fascinating more than it did the previous time. Here's some of the stories of the day. Presidential Press Secretary Scott McClellan has stressed that several national security agencies approved a deal that will turn six U.S. ports over to a firm run by the government of the United Arab Emirates, an agreement that has been very heavily criticized now by federal lawmakers. They are finally jumping on this bandwagon, and it's about time. A merger deal approved by the government's Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States has the company currently running the ports. It's a London-based company, but it's been acquired by the Dubai Ports World for six-some billion dollars. Now, this area of the United Arab Emirates has known ties to terrorists, including the 9/11 hijackers, raising concerns about security issues at the ports involved, which again are New York, Baltimore, New Jersey, New Orleans, Miami, and Philadelphia. I've seen a lot of stories cross my desk. We've looked at a lot of stories here on Coast to Coast. This will go down in history as one of the dumbest moves I've ever seen. Does anybody agree with it? The hunter shot by Dick Cheney says that accidents do and will happen, and he said he is sorry for all the hullabaloo and scrutiny that the incident has brought about the vice president and his family. He said he's sorry. This past weekend encompassed all of us, he says, in a cloud of misfortune and sadness that is not easy to explain, especially to those who are not familiar with the great sport of quail hunting. Now, this from Austin attorney Harry Whittington, who was discharged from the hospital on Friday. He added that his family, they are deeply sorry for all the vice president and his family had to deal with this week. And he says, we hope we will continue, that they will come to Texas and seek the relaxation that he deserves. Whittington's appearance in front of a Corpus Christi hospital in Texas was the first since the 78-year-old was accidentally shot in the face, neck, and chest by the vice president during a quail hunting trip last weekend. He did not answer questions. A federal jury has handed Merck & Company, that's the big pharmaceutical company, a major victory when it cleared the drug maker of any responsibility in the death of a 53-year-old Florida man who had a heart attack after taking its once popular painkiller Vioxx for less than a month. This was a second court victory for Merck and its first in a federal court. The company had argued in this case that the plaintiff's lawyers never proved any link between Vioxx and the heart attack that Richard Dickey Irvin suffered in 2001. Merck's lawyers contended that Irvin's age, gender, and diet all put him at risk for heart attacks, and they won. For the second time in 3 months, a 16-year-old California girl who lost a leg in a horrible accident has had her artificial limbs stolen. How low can people get? Melissa Huff, an Arcadia High School student who uses a $16,000 limb to play softball for the school team and another one valued at $12,000 for everyday use, said both of them were taken from her bedroom. Police are trying to find neighbors, relatives, anybody who might have information about the missing legs. In November, thieves broke into their residence and took her limb. After that incident, Melissa's prosthetics and other doctors donated about $16,000 for a new limb. Now that's been stolen too. In the Philippines, rescue workers held little hope of finding more survivors from a devastating landslide, saying a farming village was swallowed whole by a wall of mud and boulders. The highest-ranking military officer at the scene estimated the death toll at around 1,800, nearly every man, woman, and child who lived in this town. Greenland's glaciers, as we reported yesterday, are sliding towards the sea much faster than previously believed, according to scientists. It was thought that the entire Greenland ice sheet could melt in about 1,000 years, but the latest evidence suggests that this could happen much sooner. It implies that sea levels will rise a great deal faster as well, and that means heavy flooding. In a moment, we're going to talk about freaks of the storm, strange weather with our special guest, Randy Cervani, in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Randy Cervani is a professor, specializes in weather and climate in the Department of Geography at Arizona State University. His work has ranged from looking at the weather associated with prison escapes to computing the weather of the next 10,000 years. He also manages the Arizona Thunderstorm Chase Project, which is an effort between the university and the National Weather Service to better forecast and warn about summer monsoon thunderstorms, and is an editor of the popular-based weather magazine WeatherWise. Currently, he's working on the World Meteorological Organization to develop a global database of extreme weather records. He's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Randy, how are you?
Just fine.
We're going to have fun talking about some of the freaks of the storm in your new book, but I've got to ask you about some of this latest weather news that has been popping up over the last couple days, where a NASA scientist claims he was gagged about talking about the ice sheets in Greenland and other reports that came out of St. Louis, where they held a conference on the weather. The things really are heating up much faster than they thought. Is that something we should all be concerned about now?
Well, it is quite definitely a matter of debate among the scientific community that there are good indications that certain parts of the world are experiencing dramatic changes. The problem that we have is trying to differentiate between what's being caused by us, anthropogenic or human-based kind of changes, compared to what natural cycles are occurring. And the problem is that we don't know everything that there is to know about weather, all there is to know about climate. And so trying to say this is something that's the result of our warming up of the atmosphere or it's a natural cycle, it's still quite difficult to try to figure out.
Randy, if the poles melt and the ice sheets melt, is that enough water to really erode the coastlines of most countries?
Oh, absolutely. If you were to have Greenland slide into the ocean, or Antarctica, part of Antarctica slide into the ocean and cause a massive melt of those ice sheets, you could raise sea level by 200 feet.
Just that region?
Just that region,
Oh, yeah. My gosh. That would just wipe out every coastline, practically.
Right, and in fact, oddly enough, along with that movie that was out the day after tomorrow, if you did that, the likelihood is you would change the ocean currents enough that you maybe could even cascade the Earth into an ice age, oddly enough.
All right, what are the chances of all this happening in our lifetime?
Frankly, at least in the stuff that I have studied, I would say pretty small. That we're looking at those kind of changes happening, if they were to happen, in the next century, not so much in the next few decades. So maybe our grandchildren would really, if this kind of process continues to accelerate, they would be the ones that would have to experience this. But climate systems probably aren't going to change that immediate, so that, you know, next year or next decade we would have to worry about it, but maybe next century is when we're looking at those kind of things really being pronounced.
Okay, I'm looking at your book, Freaks of the Storm, and while I was perusing it, I catch the cover where it goes from flying cows to stealing thunder. Flying cows? You got to tell me about that.
Well, if you remember that movie Twister, they showed the, yeah, the storm chasers out, and then the cow goes by. Well, that's actually based on, believe it or not, observer reports that we have had many cases in the last century of people observing flying cows, that tornadoes will pick up cows, carry them pick up horses, carry them, and even pick up people and carry them safely in some cases quite a distance from where they started from.
Safely. Have there ever been any reports of people in animals, though, that just didn't make the trip?
Oh, absolutely. That's the more common type of situation. The freak is when actually you can find somebody or something that has been carried safely. But since tornado winds are so nasty and so unpredictable, things can get torn apart, things can get jammed with other bits of debris. And so the normal situation is people are going to die if they get caught in a tornado. But occasionally there are a few freaks where they can survive.
How did you end up writing this book, Freaks of the Storm?
Well, part of it has to do with the fact that we need to have a global database of these kinds of records. That in order to judge if the kind of warming that's being reported over Greenland is something we should be concerned about, we need to know the history of what's happened in the past. And so one part of weather history is to trying to find out the freaks, the things that are unusual. And by looking at those, hopefully we can figure out what's causing them and maybe even find out more about what makes our weather tick.
Are we getting more of these freak storms in this era than we did, let's say, 50 or 100 years ago?
I don't think so. I think what's happening is we're reporting them more. There's more people, obviously, so there's more chance that people can see them. But also, we have better communication systems so that when strange things happen, we're more likely to hear about it than, say, 100 or 200 years ago.
I'm going to give you some topics of weather, and you tell me what some of the freakiest storms are or reports that you've had when you were putting together the book. Of course, I hail from the Midwest, Randy, Detroit and St. Louis, so we're in Tornado Alley, and we get them every spring. Any strange tornado stories beyond the cow flying through the air?
Well, actually, there are a lot of those kind of things. One of the things that's always interesting about trying to find these stories is to determine how much is truth and how much is fiction. And for example, when you're looking at cows or horses that are being carried up by a tornado and landing safely, how much can you believe that particular report? So a lot of times what I've tried to do is go back and contact these people, track them down, find out their names and such. And there was a story back in the 1950s of this girl. She was only 8 years old at the time. She was in South Dakota. And she was riding home from school on her horse, and a tornado came through, picked her up, carried her over 1,000 yards, over 3 fences, as a matter of fact, and actually set her down safely, and the horse as well. And I thought, well, that's just unbelievable. Well, I did a little investigation, talked to some weather meteorologists that were on TV in South Dakota, actually tracked down this woman. She's now in her 50s, she's alive, survived it, told me about the incident, and actually even sent me a picture of her on that horse back in the 1950s. So as much as possible, we always try to want to verify to see if these things can actually happen.
Any idea how high she went?
Well, of course, I have a feeling she was probably concerned about more things than trying to figure out how high she was. But in some cases, we've had people that have been lifted over 2 or 3 story buildings and landed on the other side. So we know that they can definitely be carried quite a distance.
The power of tornadoes. What happens, Randy? Do they get caught in the spinning, the vortex of it?
Right, and see, that's the possibility of how they could survive, is that these winds in a tornado are so incredibly strong, but only in a very limited space. And so you might get shot up and spun just enough to move you, but then hit an area of weaker winds and be more carefully dropped so that you could survive something like that. I think it's the abrupt changes in wind speed that are associated with a tornado that could, on rare occasions, allow somebody to survive.
We have a guest by the name of Daniel Brinkley, who has clinically died a couple times having been hit by lightning. That's got to be a situation that I hope I never find myself in.
Yeah, and actually, it is a quite profound experience, even if you don't clinically die but are just hit and knocked unconscious or suffer some other damage. One of the major problems that we find with lightning victims is the psychological damage that is done to them afterwards. That one of my good friends, who's a leading lightning medical doctor, has put together a lightning survivors group that really tries to help each other get over some of the traumas that are associated with being struck by lightning.
Have you ever heard of anybody getting hit by these plasma balls of light? Have you heard of those?
Well, I mean, probably the closest thing that is related to that would be balls of lightning or these kind of glowing spheres of discharge that are usually associated with some kind of a thunderstorm. The problem is that we frankly don't know what they are. As you said, one theory is that they might be plasma. Just recently, some Israeli scientists were able to recreate something in the lab that they said might be ball lightning. But because ball lightning occurs so rarely, we have anecdotal accounts of it. We have personal stories of people that have survived or seen ball lightning. But it happens so rarely, we cannot yet figure out precisely what it is. We can't recreate it in the lab and know for sure that, oh yeah, what's in the lab is actually what we see out in the real world.
Will it char you if you got hit by one?
It can. Actually, believe it or not, most times when people are struck by lightning, there's no immediate physical damage. That lightning, when it strikes you, actually doesn't go through you very often. It goes around you. And consequently, the biggest problem that we have when somebody is struck by lightning is cardiac arrest. As you said, you can be clinically dead.
Sure.
Because your heart actually stops beating. One common misperception is that if somebody's been struck by lightning, you don't want to touch them because they're electrically charged. Well, that's nonsense. They are not charged. And if you start applying CPR immediately, there's a darn good chance that you can actually revive somebody from a lightning strike.
Randy, if you're talking to somebody on a landline in your house, you know, the old phones, and there's lightning outside, is that dangerous? Because I've always heard these rumors that if lightning hit, it could go through the line and go right into your ear, into your head. Is that true?
Well, I can tell you a personal story. I grew up in a little town in Nebraska, and we were out in a rural area. We had a landline, and the lightning hit the telephone pole right outside our house. The charge went through the line, and our wall phone literally exploded
into
thousands of little molten pieces. Now, luckily, none of us were on the phone at the time, but we heard this loud bang out in our living room, ran out, and our living room floor was just covered with little bits of phone. So had somebody been talking, they would not have survived that.
So word to the wise, when it's lightning out and you're on a phone like that, hang up, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Now, as you said, that's a landline. If you're on a cell phone, it's actually okay because the idea is the charge does not easily travel through air. So a cell phone's a relatively safe thing to use during a lightning storm.
I remember a couple of years ago, I was stuck in a hailstorm, and I got to tell you, they were as big as golf balls, and I was able to quickly get my car under some shelter. In the next day, insurance companies set up sections and parking lots where people just drove their car in, and they were just writing them checks, Randy. It was just amazing. Hail is getting bigger, not smaller. Why?
Well, one thing, again, is we have more people out to observe it. So, you know, if hail hits an isolated field where nobody is at, nobody's going to be able to say, oh, this is a hailstone of a certain size. When you have a lot more people that are living in areas that are hit by hail, there's more likely a chance that somebody can pick one up and say, oh, this is the record hailstone. But given that, you're right, that within just the last couple years, we set an all-time record for the United States in terms of the size of a hailstone. Believe it or not, it was something on the order of 17 inches around. I'd hate to have been underneath of that when it actually hit. But it was a little town in Aurora, Nebraska.
And let me ask you this. Why don't we have more huge ice chunks falling on us? Why doesn't that happen?
Well, you know, first of all, a hailstone is the result of, if you will, of a roller coaster ride through a thunderstorm, that you start out with a little ice crystal, and as it is going up and down through a thunderstorm because of the updrafts and the downdrafts, each time through, it's picking up more ice as more ice collects.
I see.
And actually, it's kind of interesting. If you cut a hailstone in half, very often what you will see is rings that are indicating these passages through different layers of the atmosphere, and you can literally kind of see the age, if you will, of a hailstone by the rings that you see when you cut a hailstone open.
How neat. I don't know what's going on with the weather, though, Randy. Yesterday in St. Louis, it was 70, and by nighttime, it was 20. I mean, 50-degree drop? What's going on?
Well, right now, we're in a weather pattern that is fairly unstable. And so we get these very abrupt changes. Like, for example, here in Phoenix, Arizona, we've gone now 122 days without rain. But conversely, places like Portland, Oregon, and Seattle, Washington, have gone for many, many days with straight rainfall this winter.
Yeah,
so it's been a very, very odd winter.
Too bad Mother Nature can't balance that out. Stay with us, Randy. We're going to talk more about some freaks of the storm. Also, we'll open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to talk with him, too. He's a climatologist. He's a good one. Randy Cervani. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment with all of you on Coast to Coast AM. Well, looking for something to do this weekend, you might want to watch the Predictions television show. You can do it right off your computer. There's a link at coasttocoastam.com right at the bottom of the homepage. Or you can go to www.predictions.tv, all right? Predictions.tv. Or if you're so inclined and you want to wait a little bit, you can order the DVD and just wait a week or two before they get it to you. So that's predictions.tv. And climatologist Randy Cervani, our guest this hour, your phone calls. Randy, it seems every year we seem to break the records from the previous years. What happened last year with all these tropical storms and hurricanes? What was the reason for this?
Well, the primary reason is due to a natural site. Well, first of all, you're right. It was an unprecedented year. Unprecedented, by the way, though, means basically for the last 60 years that we have really good records of how many hurricanes,
true,
and how many tropical storms.
Record keeping,
yeah,
as we say.
Yeah. Right. And that's something that we're trying to work on, is to try to improve our knowledge of what's happened in earlier times by looking at different kinds of records as well. But you're right. It's something that we really hadn't seen. There are two possible reasons for that. The primary one is that we're coming into a natural upturn in the number of hurricanes. That the 80s and 90s were relatively mild hurricanes. Now, we had a few in there like Andrew and such that were big, terrible storms.
Sure.
But if you look back at the records, you'll find that the 60s and 70s were actually just chock full of really bad hurricanes, like Hurricane Camille. And we seem to have seen in at least the last century that that's the way that hurricane activity goes. It goes in roughly 20 years of really good, strong activity, followed by 20 years of weaker, milder activity, and consequently, these first couple decades of this century are likely to be more powerful hurricanes, and I think we definitely saw this with last year. That's unfortunate because it means that this upcoming year and the next few years, we're also going to see that kind of hurricane activity.
See, and I'm seeing right now, this year, this early year, incredible things happening here in Los Angeles. You know, winds 50, 60 miles an hour, gusts even higher, to the point where a few weeks ago they shut the Burbank Airport down for a while because you couldn't land, you couldn't take off. It was too windy.
That is another aspect of these very marked, persistent weather patterns that we've had this particular winter. As we were talking about right before the break, the Southwest here has been incredibly dry this winter, yet the Northwest has been incredibly wet. And it's due to the fact that the storm track has taken all of those storms up to the north and into that area and left the Southwest relatively dry. Well, what do we get if we have dry conditions? We tend to have very strong winds. And so it's unfortunate, but when you have dry winds, you also get a lot of dust as well. So it's been a pretty bad winter for the Southwest, and particularly for California this winter.
Before we go to the calls, what is the weirdest weather story you've ever heard? Ever?
Probably the stuff that is associated with lightning in terms of nudity. Believe it or not,
Nudity.
Back in the Middle Ages, particularly, they would find people that had been struck by lightning, and they'd find them completely naked. And they said, what's going on? Even today, when we find lightning victims, very often they're not wearing shoes. And what happens here is when lightning hits your body, 54,000 degrees of heat, it immediately turns all your sweat to steam. And it literally can blow your shoes off or blow your clothes off.
You're kidding.
And so We think that's the primary reason why we find a lot of lightning victims that aren't wearing shoes. Literally, their shoes have been blown off by the sweat turning to steam.
All right, someone's going to invent then a portable lightning machine and walk by people and zap them. To the phones we go. Let's pick it up by going west of the Rockies, first of all. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
This is Jeff from the beautiful Rockies in the middle of Utah.
Hey, and, Jeff.
I want to tell you, I'm a late-night working scientist, George, and we really appreciate your show. It helps us pass the long hour. Science is more boring usually than it is exciting.
Well, thanks.
I had a question for your guest. In the movie, in the film Day After Tomorrow, they talk about shutting down the Gulf Current because of increased melts from the Greenland ice shelf. And yet at the same time, most climatologists poo-pooed that because they said, oh, it's going to take a long time to melt. Yes, it could happen, but it's going to take a very long time. And yet this last climatological report that they tried to shut down at NASA suggests that the melt can occur at a much more rapid pace now, frighteningly fast, unprecedented in terms of predictions by previous scientists. I'm curious what your guest has to say about this. Is there a risk of shutting down the Gulf Current and causing significant, northern hemisphere, especially northern European climate changes?
What do you think, Randy?
Well, I think there is, actually. The problem, again, that we have is that the knowledge that we have on the what's called the North Atlantic deep water, this current that is a global mechanism that transfers salt throughout the entire world's oceans, is something that we've only discovered relatively recently. We do know that, as I just said, it's kind of a salt mover around the Atlantic, goes all the way into the Pacific and over into the Indian Oceans. And if you disrupt that, the climate models suggest that you could just literally completely disrupt the entire world's climate. And the best way to disrupt that is at this little area right around Greenland where the water from the Gulf Stream, that hot water river that is running right along the east coast of the United States, dips down and starts to go deep into the Atlantic Ocean. Well, if you put in a whole bunch of fresh water from melting glaciers there, the climate models suggest that could really totally disrupt climate around the world. And it could happen very rapidly.
All right, very good. Thanks for your call. Appreciate you being on Coast to Coast. I don't know if you knew this or not, Randy, but the movie, The Day After Tomorrow, based on Art Bell and Whitley Strieber's book, The Coming Global Superstorm.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And it is something that we are continuing to study, is how fast that kind of event could happen. The last time it happened was roughly about 10,000 years ago. It was an abrupt 1,000-year cooling that we think was due to a massive influx of icebergs into that North Atlantic deep water circulation.
All right, here is a Mr. Wizard question for you, okay? Most of the rainwater comes from where? Oceans?
Most of the rainwater, it is rising from evaporation off of the ocean.
Okay, how come rain doesn't come down salty? Is because the salt's too heavy and just merely stays in the ocean? Why doesn't it come down also with the rain?
Well, actually, believe it or not, in order to get a rain droplet, you need to have something for which the water can collect around, can condense onto. Because remember, water vapor is not going to have salt in it. It's a gas, and it's the water that is going to be evaporating from that water. But in order for it to condense and create a rain droplet, you basically need to have something like a salt crystal or a piece of dirt to collect around. That's why, after a rainstorm, if you go out and look at your car, it's dirty. And you would think to yourself, well, why after a rainstorm?
Yeah, it should have been clean, sure.
Yeah. But in each one of those little rain droplets are thousands of little pieces, in particular the Southwest here, of dirt that is needed in order to have water collect around. If you have a perfectly clean atmosphere, it is very, very hard to get it to actually rain.
I didn't know that. Okay, so if you have a bucket full of rainwater, are you saying you can't drink it?
it does actually have pollutants in it, but usually the concentration of those compared to the amount of water is so small that it's not really terribly bad to drink. Although, again, things like acid rain and such tell you that there are pollutants that are in these waters that are falling out of the sky.
First time caller line, welcome to the program. Where are you calling from?
Hi, my name is Clark. I'm calling from Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada.
Welcome to the program, Clark.
Thank you for having me. I'm actually in the midst of researching and shooting for a documentary up here. And it pretty much all pertains to some of the hot topics going on, which have, you know, fueled me through the night listening to your show and kept me percolated with questions. And I guess what I've found is through my research in climatology, and I'm trying to link this to the Mayan calendar, I found James McKenney to be absolutely helpful in this. And through trying to find corollaries between what really is affecting our weather and our climate trends, I found I don't know if Randy knows of a name by a German researcher named Theodor Landsheet.
That one doesn't ring bells immediately, I'm afraid.
Yeah, he's somebody to look into because he's showing direct corollaries between solar cycles and climatological trends, and pretty much has shown how these adversely affect conditions such as El Nino and Gulf streams, and fascinating individual.
And there's an important tank out there, Randy, of good scientists and thinkers who are beginning to think the sun has a lot to do with our weather now.
Oh, absolutely. And actually, one of the ones that is one of the top scientists in the field that does that kind of research is a scientist by the name of Sally Balunas. And she was actually, if you remember the movie Contact.
I love that movie.
Yeah, she was one of the people that that character, the main character in that movie, was patterned after.
The one that Jodie Foster played.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. And she is a person that looks at things like sunspots and the timing of sunspots and the size of sunspots and such, and is trying to link those to various climate changes that are going on the Earth and finding some very fascinating results.
Okay, anything else, Clark? Any follow-up?
Yeah, I got to tell you, one of the key things that really struck me, and this is a case example of living in Winnipeg here, and it wasn't until I read Theodore's work that really struck me right in the head, because, you know, I watch spaceweather.com every day, and here I saw X classes, you guys know, July 16th of just the last summer that passed, we had X, I don't remember exactly, but they're over in the teens and the 20s, and it was just unprecedented for a Maunder minimum, which is supposed to be very quiet. And what I found the next day, okay, this was just so strange. I am a Star Trek fan, and as I found the next day, I'd sort of forgotten about it. I was sitting at my friend's, and we were sitting there, and the lightning, George and Randy, I can tell you, living in Winnipeg my whole life, I've never seen, and my friends that are older than me, they've never seen anything like this. It was like being in a nebula, and I compared it to Star Trek when they flew into a nebula, and there was like some kind of communication going on. But here it was. One case scenario, a day after a huge burst of X-rays, and it happened again. I'm emphatic about this because it seems to be a huge corollary, but it happened again on June 1st, and then it happened again on September 1st. In all three case scenarios, they all correlated with a day, so within about 24 to 30 hours of solar prominences and solar storms. So I'd like to get to turn this into a question, how far are climatologists at this particular point in academia getting to, and if any other examples come to your mind, I'm looking for people to interview on this that have made these correlative jumps in academia to show the electrical connection between these main bodies of fields, which being solar physics and climatology.
Well, one of the problems that we have with trying to link solar activity with weather on the Earth is why certain areas of the Earth would only be affected in comparison to others. One of the classic studies that was done with trying to link solar cycles to, say, for example, drought in the Midwest, suggested that because we had drought in the 1930s, drought in the 1950s, drought in the 1990s, that there is a drought cycle that is linked to a solar cycle, the double sunspot cycle that goes on in the sun. But the question then is, why would it only influence the Midwestern part of the United States and not other parts of the world? And so we have a problem with trying to say it's solar activity, because if it was, it would seem like it should affect the Earth as a unit as opposed to maybe necessarily just certain regions.
Very good. Let's go to our wildcard line. You're on Coast to Coast. It's your turn. Hi there.
Hi, this is John, and I'm calling you from Volcano, Hawaii.
Hi, John. How are you? Sound like you're near a volcano, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, I'm on a cell phone, so if I break up, I'll try to keep up with you here.
Sure.
Anyway, I've seen two pretty spectacular lightning events. And the first one was out in Nevada, in north central Nevada, where I used to live in a little town called Hazen. And Hazen is on Highway 50. It used to be a little railroad town. It was the site of the last lynching in Nevada. Anyway, I was watching a lightning storm that was playing out in a mountain range that was about 5 miles away at the base of a dry lake. And the lightning was, the clouds were hanging down probably to within 1,000 feet of the ground. And I was watching some lightning that was lighting up these mountains in the background very vividly. And then it seemed that in between the lightning and the mountain, all of a sudden, for just a few seconds, as the lightning went on and off, I saw a very large spherical shaped object, something that was, it looked to be an object. It looked maybe metallic, and it was very large, but only saw it for a second, never did figure out what that was. And another time, I was driving truck over Donner Pass. This was in the winter of 1983, which was a very heavy snowfall year, and I saw, I don't know if it was lightning or they call it snow lightning, and it was appearing in the trees as I was driving over the top of the hill. I pulled over on the side of the road, and very bright light, also I could say circular in shape, and you could just barely see it through the snow, although it was very bright, lit up the trees and lit up the snow, but had no sound to it.
Well, I've got to tell you, there's nothing more awe-inspiring than to see these lightning storms without the rain. They're gorgeous, aren't they, Randy?
Oh, absolutely. And he's right. This winter, in fact, I've heard a number of reports of what is called thunder snow, where you have thunder and lightning during a snowstorm. This last big nor'easter that we had that hit the East Coast, there were lots of reports as that nor'easter was working its way along New York State of situations where it was actually snowing very hard, and yet they were hearing thunder and in some cases seeing massive strikes of lightning. It's usually much harder to get lightning during a snowstorm because you don't get the charge separation from the water droplets that you do with rain. But it is possible to have lightning with a snowstorm, and it seems to be a pretty common occurrence, at least so far this winter. I've seen lots of reports of that kind of situation, of actually having lightning during a snowstorm.
Do you think we are in the beginning of an ice age, as some believe?
If you want to look at the long term, yes, there is absolutely no question about that, because we go in cycles that are associated with the Earth's orbit, and in the next few thousand years, regardless of what happens with global warming, eventually the carbon is going to go out of our atmosphere. We won't have anything more to put into it. And orbital mechanics, the changes in the Earth's orbit, say we are going to go into a new ice age. By 60,000 years from now, we'll be deep in an ice age.
Let's go to our final quick call. You're on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, George and Randy.
Hey.
Hi, this is Kurt. I'm calling from Cincinnati. I'm one of your truck driver friends.
Yes, sir.
A long time ago when I was in high school, a geography teacher was in the Air Force, and he related a story about a friend of his that bailed out of a plane. He was a pilot, and he got caught in a hail cloud.
Oh.
And the way the hail does, it circulates down and up, it circles around, and he got caught in that until finally it shot him out of it. And he felt it pretty bad. He was, like, swollen all over his whole body.
But he came out of it alive, though, thank God.
Yes, he survived it. But I never heard of anything like that before.
And actually, that person's name probably was Rankin. There is a documented story of a pilot who bailed out of a plane during a thunderstorm, and like you mentioned, the thing about a thunderstorm are there updrafts and downdrafts that will yank somebody up or push somebody down, and he was in there for, I believe, something like upwards of 20 minutes before he actually fell out. In another case, back in World War II, some glider pilots were forced to bail out during a thunderstorm. They weren't so lucky. They were pulled up in the cloud, and ice actually started to form on them, making them literally human hailstones, and they fell out of the sky.
Just huge, like a huge snowball.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, that wraps it up for the hour. The book, of course, is called Freaks of the Storm. Where do you get it, Randy?
At almost any bookstore or on Amazon.com.
Okay, here's my quick trivia question for you, since you brought up the movie Contact, one of my favorites. Jodie Foster, that character who played that real, the real-life person played her. What was her name in the movie? Do you know? You remember?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot. I cannot remember her name.
Ellie.
Ellie, that's right.
Okay,
that's right.
Thanks, Randy. Great information. I come back, 3 hours of open lines right here on Coast to Coast AM.